dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who has among many credentials was service as a naval intelligence officer. He went on to a host of other things, including serving as an assistant secretary of state in the George W. Bush administration, as well as doing tours in the Reagan and George H.W. Bush White Houses. I'm speaking, of course, of Robert Charles, who you frequently see at Fox News, and we're always pleased as a frequent guest here at Secure Freedom Radio. We've got a lot to talk with him about, and I'm so pleased he was able to find some time for us. Robert, welcome back. It's good to have you.
Thank you, Frank.
Well, the news of the day is that an attack of a vicious kind has taken place in some 8 different locations in Sri Lanka over the Easter holiday, killing hundreds of people and wounding many, many more. What we're being told, Bobby, and I wanted just to sort of get your thoughts on this, is that there was, in fact, warning of, if not the precise nature of the attack, certainly that they would be targeted at churches. There's also now an association being made with at least a local, well, I call them Sharia supremacist jihadist group, possibly with ties to others. What's your current assessment of this based on the limited information we have at the moment?
Well, you know, Frank, I spent a couple of months actually living in India and had a Tamil translator at the time during the period of the civil war in Sri Lanka. And so my first impression was that this was not what it now appears to be. I thought it perhaps was something that was a carryover. The intelligence reports that suggest that they knew something and didn't act are troubling in that part of the world, since it is a place where this was not would not naturally have been expected from a radical Islamic terrorist group, but appears to have been the work of such a group. The average intelligence officer there in India or in Sri Lanka did not believe this was credible. On the other hand, when you get information that looks like it may be credible, and the most important aspect is to move it quickly, get it corroborated, and then take action, because if it's actionable, you should be warning people and preventing it. The part that really strikes me as the most surprising, and this is a place where you wouldn't have expected an attack of this sort, which makes us all be on guard anywhere we are. Islamic terrorism is often planned far in advance, and we need to be attentive to that. But the part that I find is most interesting is how well coordinated the event was, which makes me think it was not a random or local organization. It may have been Pakistani. It may have been for other locations closer to the heart of the Middle East. I don't know yet. We don't know. But I do think it's telling that the events, and we had ultimately, I think you had 9 locations at least. Some were basically end games where the police intercepted somebody and it was a suicide bomber who put off, set off the bomb there. But it was very well coordinated, and it obviously took a lot of time to prepare. And I think we ought to take more seriously intelligence that suggests these things could be afoot.
Yeah. Let me ask you about another important story that has just broken as we're speaking, Robert Charles, and that is in your old department, the Department of State. Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, has made an important announcement today concerning an end to a program that, frankly, I couldn't quite figure out why we were doing it, to allow some countries to continue to import oil from Iran, clearly providing ongoing revenue streams and therefore life support to a regime that I think the administration has rightly regarded as one of the most dangerous on the planet. What's going on?
You know, it's an excellent point that you make, Frank, about how unique this was, is, and actually it fits into a pattern that makes me think that the Trump administration, both the White House and folks like John Bolton at the National Security Council, as well as Mike Pompeo, seasoned former head of CIA, that they have a real plan here and an end game and a strategy in dealing with Iran. What they did is they initially implemented a set of sanctions which would fall upon countries and actors which bought Iranian oil. But at the same time, they waived those sanctions for a set of countries that we in particular wanted to give some advance warning to, and also to allow the rest of the oil-producing world, including the United States and Saudi Arabia, to make up the gap if Iranian oil was effectively taken off the market. What we're trying to do now is say, look, the period of waiver during which we will not sanction a country or actors within a country for buying Iranian oil is now ending, and it'll end on May 2nd. And at that moment, some remarkable things will occur. Other countries will pick up the gap, contracts will shift away from Iran, and there will be since oil is the primary revenue source for the Iranian government, it will fundamentally affect the way that government can operate. It will probably create significant discontent within the country among the population. It will put new economic pressure on them from in a range of areas. The point I would make, though, about this is that it's really a dot along a longer line, and the line and the trajectory of the line is what is so interesting. About 6 weeks ago, the United States, very suddenly, but in a very, very, I think, well thought out way, imposed sanctions on 31 entities, about 17 organizations and 14 people that were all tied to Iran along the lines of having been contributors in one form or another to their nuclear program. So we sent really a very strong message that they are not to restart that program, and that anybody involved in it, and anybody that even talks to and gets involved with transacts business with any of these organizations is now on a blacklist, and it's a significant one. 2 weeks later, so about 2 weeks ago, almost exactly, we put out a dictum which is brand new as well, State Department, that we named the Iranian Revolutionary Guard as a foreign terrorist organization, an FTO. It's the first time we have ever named a part of a government as a foreign terrorist organization. It's completely accurate because they are very much tied to Hamas, Hezbollah, and terror globally. But it was a very bold move, again putting pressure on Iran. Now, on May 2nd, we will suddenly be lifting the waivers and putting new economic pressure on Iran. And so the real question becomes, if you're not just trying to highlight, which I don't think we are, I don't think we're just trying to highlight. I think we're trying to be more substantive. What are we really trying to do? I think, number one, we're trying to empower the people and the organizations in and around that country that want freedom to get a shot at it. Second, we're trying to clip the wings of terrorist organizations, including especially Hezbollah, but other organizations globally. And finally, I think we're trying to get Iran to rethink the idea of negotiating a nuclear accord and getting, you know, some portion of a new regime or of the current regime renegotiating the whole idea of a nuclear accord and getting out of the business of making nuclear weapons ever. Remember, this is also a country that just launched a submarine-launched cruise missile, and so they're not, and they have clearly adverse eyes on Israel. So this is not a friendly country.
Needless to say, death to Israel followed always by death to America is something that we ignore at our extreme peril. Bobby, we have to leave it at that. I'm sorry to say there's more that I wanted to talk with you about, including some of your thoughts about the destruction of much of the marvelous cathedral of Notre Dame and what we should be doing next about that, but that's for another day. Thank you for your time today, as well as the great work that you continue to do. Your service to our country continues, I'm happy to say, at places like Fox News and Robert Charles Associates. Keep it up, my friend. Come back to us again soon. Next up, we'll speak with Andy McCarthy. We'll get his assessment of the damage done by the Mueller report and what comes next, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
It's impossible to overstate how thrilled I am to have our next guest with us. He is Andy McCarthy. He is, by my lights at least, and I think a lot of others as well, the single most thoughtful legal beagle with real understanding of the national security challenges of our time, who writes prolifically at a number of places, including, of course, at National Review. He's also now a contributor at Fox News. He is, in short, the indispensable man. We're very appreciative of him joining us once again. Andy McCarthy, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Frank, it's great to be back and great to be with you. Thanks for the kind words.
Well, they're heartfelt. Let me just ask you for a quick assessment of where we are post Mueller report release. There's a lot of news on it. You've been commenting and writing about it. Give us just the short course on who's up, who's down, where we go from here.
Yeah, I think to cut to the chase, Frank, I wrote a column in December of 2017, which I think holds up pretty well, that said it's already clear that there's no collusion. It seems at this point that it's plainly a obstruction investigation, and the likelihood of finding prosecutable obstruction is remote, and therefore the obstruction investigation is an impeachment investigation. That was December 2017, and I think that probably is where we're at. It looks to me like it must have been clear that there was no collusion criminal offense by a time very shortly after Special Counsel Mueller was appointed in May of 2017. The investigation at the time he took it over was principally an obstruction investigation. Remember, Mueller is appointed the same week that Comey is fired, but it's not quite the same week. It's like 8 days after. And it is the same week that the acting FBI director, Andrew McCabe, opens an obstruction investigation against the president specifically. So this really, I think, came principally to Mueller as an obstruction investigation, even though it was carried under the guise of a counterintelligence investigation on Russia's interference in the election. I think thereafter, they investigated obstruction on a theory of law that I don't think is viable. And I don't think, even though it's Mueller's theory, I don't think the Justice Department will have an interest in having that persist as the department's interpretation of obstruction for reasons that we can discuss. But ultimately, Mueller didn't resolve the obstruction issue. It was obviously resolved by Attorney General Barr on a more traditional Justice Department interpretation of the law of obstruction. But the fact that, as we've discussed, I think before, Frank, you were good enough to have me on years back when, after I had written a book about impeachment, I wasn't prescient enough to wait to write an impeachment book until Trump was president. I could have made a few bucks.
it was no sell in the Obama years, that's for sure.
No, not in those times. But as the book argues, and this is not really an argument, this is a fact, Congress does not need a penal offense in order to impeach. A high crime and misdemeanor can be an indictable criminal law offense, but it need not be. So where we're at, I think, is there's evidence that is relevant to an obstruction investigation. It wasn't enough in the view of the Justice Department to prove obstruction beyond a reasonable doubt, as you would have to do it in court, but it's always open to Congress on a theory that the president has abused his powers to at least investigate the matter for impeachment purposes.
Yeah. So we've now been hearing from different voices in Congress, Nancy Pelosi saying he's not worth it, Steny Hoyer saying that, you know, this will be resolved in the election process, as I recall. And most recently, Jerry Nadler saying, well, yeah, no, this is an impeachable offense if can be proven. And we're going to go to work on it with encouragement from the likes of Elizabeth Warren. And I imagine now a number of others in the presidential contest on the Democratic side. So do you anticipate at the end of the day that we will see the House of Representatives initiating an impeachment process against the president on the basis of its perception of these obstruction charges, and that we will, you know, have this thing run its course to actually have, you know, the president indicted in the nature of an impeachment?
I think there will be the opening of impeachment hearings, Frank, and how far it goes is going to depend on what the public opinion polls say, and I think the trajectory of the presidential election. You know, it's interesting because I think we dealt with this on the right during the Obama years, and the Democrats are just becoming familiar with the phenomenon now, and that is that the base of the party is more ideological than the mainstream of the party in Congress. And in the Democrats' case, the base is harder left. I mean, it's hard to imagine those of us like you and I of a certain age who've been following Nancy Pelosi's career.
The moderate centrist Nancy Pelosi.
Yeah, so it goes to show how far the center has moved. But the dynamic that I think we saw in the 2008 and 2012, or the 2012 and 2016 cycles in particular, is that a lot of times the mainstream of the party in Congress does not really wish to do something, but the base of the party wants it. And because of the dynamic of a presidential election, a presidential campaign, the presidential candidates who don't have to do anything in Congress, they don't actually have to be accountable for the things they say on the stump, they gravitate toward what the base wants. And what I think all the eyes are on Congress now, but I think what's going to drive this is how much the base wants Trump impeached, a lot, and how many of these flailing candidates think that by dipping from the impeachment well, they can revive their candidacy. So I think we've already seen, for example, Elizabeth Warren last week say that she thinks that we need to start with impeachment. I think she's just the first, and by the end of the week, we'll have a number of them. And I think at that point, it becomes very hard for people like Pelosi and Hoyer and Schumer and the mainstream of the Democrats in Congress to hold the line. I think they may decide that it's dumb to impeach Trump, but the process may get out of their control. Mm.
And speaking of sort of past history, does this likely redound to the president's favor in the election cycle that we are now obviously in?
Well, there's one reason I think, Frank, that the white history is a little tough to apply here, and that is that it's the role of the media. I think, in this instance, the media is going to be the wind at the Democrats' back instead of the wind in the Republicans' face, as it is with the Republican base. I think that what's in there, some of the stuff in there on obstruction with respect to President Trump is unsavory. I don't think any of it is indictable or serious enough to be impeachable. I think there's one incident in particular I'd be concerned about, and that is the, there's something in the report where there's two different transactions. One in June of 2017, Trump tells McGahn to fire Mueller. To me, that's always been a no big deal thing. The president gets to fire whoever he wants to fire. But the troubling part is 6 months later in January of 2018, it said that Trump leaned on McGahn to change his version of events about what happened in June. And that gets very close to witness tampering. So that's, I think, the one that we're going to hear the most about. And the question is, in terms of how much it resonates with people, my common sense, this is not a lawyer thing, tells me that there's 330 million people in the country. Not every one of them like us is hanging on every word of this thing. And they hear no obstruction, no collusion, and they've had it. They want to move on. But the media is going to trumpet all this obstruction stuff, and in particular witness tampering stuff. And what I can't gauge yet is how much traction it's going to get. My sense of things is that the media doesn't get traction like it used to.
But incessant pounding. Look at global warming. enough pounding away at it, you get some traction. Andy, there's obviously going to be a lot more reporting on this, and we will be following yours very closely. But just quickly, could you give us an overall assessment on one other matter, and that is the nature and extent of Russian interference in this whole drama? And in particular, the piece of it that has been studiously ignored by an awful lot of people, including Bob Mueller, of course, and that is the role that the Russians played with Hillary Clinton and her team.
Yeah, I think, Frank, that the Russian interference in the election is the most overhyped, politicized thing I've ever seen in modern times. The Russians interfere in our elections all the time. They've been doing it since the Bolshevik Revolution. And what I point out to people is that there is nothing significant about Russia's interference in the election that we know today that Obama didn't know in real time. And yet, in the last presidential debate, which happened about 2 weeks before election day at a time when they knew everything we know now. Both Hillary Clinton and Obama chastised Trump for suggesting that he wouldn't accept the legitimacy of the election until after the results were in and he could see how it all went. They acted like they were horrified. That was like the most amazing, ridiculous thing they ever heard. And then after Mrs. Clinton lost and they needed something to rationalize her defeat, suddenly it became fashionable to question the legitimacy of the election. And Obama, who not only knew about all this stuff in real time, but had done nothing virtually with respect to Russian aggression for the 8 years of his term in office, suddenly does a 180, orders Brennan, who is a very political director of the Central Intelligence Agency at the time, orders Brennan to put out an assessment of Russia's interference in the election. Now, Frank, you and I are old government guys. We know that a report like that in ordinary times would take over a year for the government to get out the door. They did it in a matter of days, and they rolled it out. They did it in a way that they wanted to make sure that it would get out when Obama was still president and they could mark it the way it went out. They rolled it out in connection with these very high profile expulsions of supposed Russian operatives and the seizure of two Russian installations here, one in Maryland and one in Long Island, and all these sanctions that were imposed. So it seems to me that what they did at that point in time was try to take something that they thought was a trifle at the time when everybody was sure Mrs. Clinton was going to win and turn it into a real thing afterwards. And I think that was done for political purposes. I have never thought that the Russian thing was a big deal. And I don't think they thought it was a big deal either until they lost.
Right. And then it became the basis for trying to destroy Donald Trump. Andy McCarthy, thank you so much for your time today, as well as the great work you do at National Review and Fox and elsewhere. Come back to us again soon, my friend. It's good to talk with you.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, joined by one of the men I've come to admire most because of his service in a dangerous part of our national security apparatus, namely as an undercover operative in the Central Intelligence Agency's clandestine services. He rose through the ranks to be a senior operations officer and served as a chief of station in a number of places. He'd have to kill you if we told you where, so we're not going to do that. But we have come to admire Brad Johnson both for his service in those capacities, but also for what he's doing these days as the president of Americans for Intelligence Reform. He knows wherever he speaks, where the bodies are buried, as they say, and it's always a delight to have him with us. Brad Johnson, welcome back. Thanks so much for taking a few minutes.
Frank, thank you so much for having me once again.
I thought of you immediately, Brad, when I read Bill Gertz's report about an essay by John Gentry, a man who served on the analysis side of the CIA house, but basically laying bare what many of us have long believed, which is that the intelligence community, the CIA specifically, has been badly politicized in recent years. And I wanted to see if that tracked with your own experience as well.
It absolutely does. It's something that we've seen across the board in the federal agencies. I think there's absolutely no question in anyone's mind we've seen that bias within the leadership at FBI and DOJ. Most assuredly, we've seen that exact same bias at the CIA and NSA. And the head of FBI, DOJ, and CIA under the former administration, under the Obama administration, they were all friends, all working on the same thing. And what we've seen is this just unrelenting targeting of President Trump, and it's by those people. Those were all the resist movement, if you will, or the deep state. I personally prefer the resist term for that because it goes well down into the ranks, and it's a lot of this is caused by the hiring practices for a very long time, which was culminating under the Obama administration. But it's a very serious problem that now has to be looked at.
Well, more than looked at, I would guess it needs to be addressed in some sort of corrective form. But before we get to what needs to be done, let me just say, John Gentry's piece appeared in the International Journal of Intelligence and Counterintelligence, and he makes it pretty clear that the slant was very much in the direction of the Democrats, whether it's the hiring practices or, I imagine, the promotion priorities, whether it's the kind of leadership that was exhibited most especially by John Brennan as the director of the Central Intelligence Agency during the second Obama term. These are people who were very clearly of a mind to turn the instruments of U.S. intelligence towards, at the very least, influencing policy, if not, as some have charged, engaging in a coup against Donald Trump. Give us your thoughts on whether such characterizations are on the mark, Brad Johnson, or overstated?
Personally, I find it to be perfectly fair criticism. John Brennan, former CIA director, James Clapper, Mike Morrell, those people were all mentioned because they all came out very publicly, very adamantly anti-Trump, to the point where they were talking about treason on the part of Trump and that he was going to be indicted and impeached.
And a Russian agent, among other things.
Precisely. And they did this with zero evidence whatsoever. They were all fully aware there was no evidence. So, I mean, how do you construe this other than it was their own personal political desire to have him out? And I think in large part, too, particularly Mike Morrell, I think these people were essentially campaigning for an onward position under what they thought was going to be a Hillary Clinton administration. So I think it's combined. Philosophically, they were in agreement, did not want Trump in, didn't think he was worthy, did everything they could do to keep him from being elected, and then they thought they could overturn the election and made every effort to do so. And I think you have to look at that. It is at the very least treasonous in nature.
Mm. Brad, you say they had no evidence. As we were just discussing with Andy McCarthy, it's worse than that. They manufactured evidence. They created out of whole cloth this whole, sort of counterintelligence narrative using fraudulently presented, at the very least, documentation to the FISA courts and from Russian sources, no less. Talk about collusion. This really does raise the question, as was pointed out by Greg Thompson in an outlet called CCN, not to be confused with CNN. The Obama team was actively sort of building the deep state that would be used for this kind of purpose. And I just wonder, to what extent do you think that this is not confined to just your old agency, the CIA, but that it has really, you mentioned the NSA a moment ago, the National Security Agency. Is this now a problem as a result of hiring by the Obama team, most especially widespread throughout the intelligence community? Brad Johnson.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Conclusively, it's a problem. And let me point out a couple of things and how this has already come to the surface, creating some very serious problems. We had just last year, Reality Winner, a young lady who took a classified document out and gave it to the press because it was anti-Trump. And she's precisely that, was somebody out of that world that had gone through the Air Force, gotten a security clearance, and then came on as a contractor. And then just last month, we had a DIA officer. We haven't mentioned DIA before, Defense Intelligence Agency, which is out of the military. And he was convicted of spying for the Chinese for a very long period of time. Now, the real key important aspect out of this, the real take-home information everybody needs to understand, is he got caught by pitching a close associate of his to cooperate with him working for the Chinese against the United States, to also betray the United States. And the basis of the pitch was that he was a resist movement guy. He was very anti-Trump, and that it was a key component of his pitch to this guy that we had to do everything to resist Trump, and it would help resist Trump if we cooperate with the Chinese. Now, that would not have taken place without the full endorsement of the Chinese intelligence service who was handling this guy. His name was Ron Hansen. Hansen, that had to have been approved by the Chinese. That means Chinese intelligence views one of the big vulnerabilities of American intelligence, of American people who hold clearances, to be the resist movement. They know that's a vulnerability. The world has figured this out. It's just not here. We're kind of like the last to figure this out here in the United States. I would urge President Trump to immediately include in the polygraph for all hiring at DIA, CIA, NSA, FBI, DOJ, all the three-letter alphabet soup organizations, he needs to immediately add a question in that says, what's more important, your personal political beliefs or the Constitution of the United States of America and protecting national security of the United States of America? Which is more important to you? And if there's any confusion on the polygraph by anyone, that guy's security clearance needs to be yanked immediately. And we need loyal citizens of the United States of America having a clearance that will keep our secrets safe. And if this is recognized by China, you're guaranteed this has made its way around. The Russians certainly are trying to take advantage of this as well, and everyone else. This is very key. I hope that President Trump hears this and will immediately include it. How controversial could it be to say, do you loyally support the Constitution of the United States of America or your own personal political beliefs? I mean, how controversial can that be?
Well, you can imagine if it has anything to do with Donald Trump, it will be very controversial, but it seems eminently sensible, I think, and long overdue, you know, frankly, especially given that, as you know so well, Brad Johnson, the role of the intelligence communities are supposed to be completely non-political. They are supposed to just be focused on developing the facts, making sure that they're available to policymakers, and then let them do the politics or let them do the at least the policy making. And you know, just coming back to the clearance issue, speaking of John Brennan, the question occurs, how did a guy who voted for the Communist Party candidate for president of the United States shortly before he entered the CIA ever get a clearance? Is this evidence of a much more widespread problem, not just with the questions, but with the kinds of analysis that was done of these background investigations?
Yes, it's endemic. I mean, it's all part of it. If you are a fellow traveler, you know, someone who's on the left, has leftist philosophies, what we call liberalism here in the United States, if you're of that ilk, that's just not something that's criticized very much. And in fact, the way that they take over an organization, like what happened at State Department following World War II, it's not so much, it does take place at the hiring level. You start to weed out the conservatives during that process, but then it gets finalized as you go up. At the entry level, there are still a mix of people, political belief-wise. But as you move up, it's not that they cut you off or something. It's more insidious. It's a process, and this is across the board in all of the federal agencies. What they do is you get positions. You're judged nowadays on your political reliability. So if it's a good job, they will pick somebody who's politically reliable to them to put in. It's no longer merit. It doesn't matter if you're competent. It doesn't matter how good of work you do. You will not get those good jobs, and you get promoted based on those jobs. So that's how they control the pipeline of who moves up, and that's why the leadership at all of these organizations, CIA, DIA, everybody, they're all the same. And it's this pipeline that's controlled of who moves up into a position of leadership. So while at the entry level, you may see a thing of where it's, say, 70-30, 70% liberal, 30% something else, as it moves up the pipeline, that narrows and narrows and narrows until it reaches the top and it's 99%. And anyone who's not liberal at the top absolutely keeps their mouth shut and their head down and doesn't let on that they have any divergence in political beliefs. It's absolutely insidious.
We have to leave it at that, my friend. Brad Johnson, thank you so much again for your service to our country in the clandestine services of the CIA, and come back to us again very soon if you would, sir. Next up, Gordon Chang joins us straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It's time for our weekly visit with one of the country's preeminent authorities on Asia, and most especially the country that is increasingly dominating it and, well, it appears much of the rest of the world, namely Communist China. He is, of course, Gordon Chang. He is the author of three terrific books, The Coming Collapse of China, Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, and most recently, Losing South Korea. He's also a contributor at the Daily Beast and, of course, at Fox News and elsewhere. It's always a delight to have him with us, though. Gordon Chang, welcome back.
Thank you so much, Frank.
Gordon, there's so much to talk about, but I did want to start with an extraordinary piece that the Washington Post saw fit to run over the weekend under the headline, "We Should Let China Spy on Us," which prompted some of us to feel as though this is rather defeatist. We should surrender now or just take us out and shoot us. What did you make of this piece?
This is fascinating because the thesis of the piece is that the more that we know about China and the more that China knows about us, the less likely there will be war. And one can say on its face, maybe that makes sense. But the problem is right now that our problem is not that the Chinese don't know anything about us. They know quite a lot for various reasons, including open source information. The problem is that China is run by a militant regime, which is headed by an ideologue named Xi Jinping. And so this has nothing to do with information about us. If you go through the arguments, the historical arguments in that piece, they just don't make sense, Frank. He talks about Nazi Germany and Stalin and a few others. It doesn't add up. But the point is, there is this reigning belief that knowledge and cooperation will lead to peace. And that just unfortunately is not true.
No, it's particularly true when what they're interested in collecting is not just, you know, what is the nature of the United States or its current attitudes towards China. They're deeply plundering our intelligence, our military technology, our, you know, economic engines and the like for the purposes of, as you've pointed out on this program and elsewhere, Gordon Chang, supplanting the United States as the dominant power in the world. And this is a deeply hostile enterprise under the Chinese Communist Party, I think it's fair to say. You don't want them emboldened by thinking that you're essentially rolling over and, you know, surrendering effectively.
Yes, you know, this is a piece probably was triggered by the report in the New York Times that the United States has either revoked visas or not granted visas to Chinese academics. And this has created quite a firestorm, as you can imagine, in the U.S. Academy. The problem here is that people don't understand that the 2017 National Intelligence Law of China actually requires Chinese nationals to spy on the U.S. if required. And of course, that's Communist Party practice. And in these particular cases, I'm sure that academics have been used by China's intelligence services to learn about American intentions and what's going on in Washington. And we need to be very concerned about this because there's, of course, the spying on our defense networks. There's spying on U.S. companies for commercial purposes. But there's also this information gathering that is going on in the guise of these cooperative academic programs. So we need to review all of this. And because we're in an emergency situation, Frank, I believe that we need to cut the links with China until we can stabilize the situation and understand the dimensions of the loss and what we should do about it. So as a priority, we should be looking very, very closely at any Chinese national who seeks a visa to the United States.
Well, this is pretty important stuff, especially when we've got 300,000 of their students in our country, to say nothing of countless other business, you know, visa holders and the like. But Gordon, you're sounding the klaxon on this is appreciated. David Fickling, the author of this piece at Bloomberg, published by the Washington Post, I think should be, well, ashamed of himself, quite frankly. Let me turn to a related subject, Gordon, just to give people a sense of the ambitions that Communist China has in terms of dominating the world and the progress it's apparently making. According to one of China's preeminent propaganda outlets, China Daily, the so-called Belt and Road Initiative, which is a major project of Xi Jinping, has now racked up engagements with 125 countries around the world, 29 international organizations, and is in the process of either completing or fulfilling for various purposes something on the order of 173 agreements. You have warned about this Belt and Road Initiative, as have others working with us in what's now called the Committee on the Present Danger, China. Specifically, Gordon, that these deals often come with very onerous terms and have effectively allowed the Chinese to dominate the countries in question and to expropriate, effectively at least, their strategic assets, ports and railroads and the like. Talk a bit about what the Belt and Road Initiative is doing and what this assessment of how widespread it now has become means for us.
Well, Xi Jinping 5 years ago announced the Belt and Road. The belt is a railroad route between the east coast of China and Europe, and the road is the water route. But it's really become greater than that because we now have a Latin America Belt and Road and Arctic Belt and Road. It is just spanning the world. And the idea is to try to change trade routes so that they all center on China. There's a lot of discussion here. As I've mentioned before, many of these projects are uneconomic and are more hurtful to China than anything else. But there are two aspects of this which are especially pernicious, and we need to focus in on them. First of all, as you point out, this debt trap diplomacy has given China access to ports which its navy can use. So, for instance, Sri Lanka, a country which is in the news recently, recently had to surrender its Hambantota port that 2 years ago China took a 99-year lease and 70% of the equity because Sri Lanka could not pay back high-interest loans. And we could probably see Chinese military vessels there. As we saw in another port in Sri Lanka, the Colombo International Container Port, which hosted a Chinese submarine and its tender in both September and October of 2014. The Chinese are now building another enormous port, this one 55 miles from West Palm Beach. That's in Freeport in the Bahamas. So we got to be concerned about that. And second of all, this is the digital Silk Road, which is an add-on. And this is tying communications around the world through China using Huawei equipment that allows China to spy on everybody, especially as we move to 5G, the fifth generation of wireless networks. So these are the two aspects of Belt and Road, which I think we really need to focus on because they pose direct and immediate threats to the United States.
Yeah, I'm so glad you mentioned the digital element of this, Gordon, because as you know, a prime mover behind that is this company Huawei, a Chinese company with extensive ties, we're told, to Chinese intelligence and the military, as well as, of course, the Communist Party. We're also being told today that Huawei's income this year has increased by 39% in the face of a concerted effort by the United States government and some others to try to raise a warning about what the implications are of doing business with Huawei, especially in the context of the 5G fifth generation wireless network. Give us a sense of what this means, if indeed Huawei is profiting at such a moment.
Huawei certainly is doing better than before. I don't know about 39%, but we got to remember that Huawei is not a private enterprise. As Don Clark, an American academic, pointed out, Huawei is essentially a Chinese state-owned entity. And so this is talking about the Chinese government, where, of course, profits don't matter. Huawei is considered to be strategic. This year is especially important because a lot of countries will be deciding on their 5G network providers. Huawei is certainly going to take the lion's share of telecommunication contracts this year. We started very, very late in our campaign to warn our intelligence and other partners about Huawei. And it's good that the Trump administration is doing this now. but this should have occurred about 15 years ago. So we're talking about problems in both the Bush and Obama administrations in not actively opposing Huawei.
Well, and it's also a call for a redoubled effort, both on 5G and with respect to these warnings. Gordon, we have to leave it at that for the moment. There's, as I say, much more to talk with you about, but I appreciate your visiting with us today, and we'll look forward to doing so again next week. I hope we'll have the chance to talk with the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.